Life's too short not to visit Uzbekistan. Life is also too short to not thoroughly enjoy a fantastic win at home against Spurs, to go 8 games unbeaten in the Premier League and 6 points clear of the drop zone. This is the Known and Never podcast.
Now then, Burnley 1, Tottenham Hotspur 0. That's the goal Burnley needed.
Yeah, we said maybe they'd score from a set piece. Fantastic delivery, wasn't it, from Dwight McNeil into the 6-yard box, into the danger area. No mistake there. Fantastic goal. Yeah, we saw Pochettino complaining on the touch. I'm not sure he's complaining about there. Like a fantastic header. Absolutely no chance the keeper in off the bar, and it's 1-0 to Burnley. Against a run of play, we have to say, in the second half, Phil, but Burnley have done really well in the first 45 minutes and got the rewards for it there.
And he's equalised. Oh, that'll be controversial.
They're going to go ballistic there. He's taken the throw.
Well, he's taken it quickly.
He's taken about 10 yards away from where it should have been.
Kane has equalised. Now then, are we going to see where this throw was taken from here?
Yeah, the ball's gone out in the Tottenham half.
I think it's the halfway line.
And he's taking it from 1, 2, 3.
It's 5 yards in
advance. And the rest.
It's really poor from Mike Dean, you know. Is that the referee's responsibility or the linesman's or a bit of both?
They're a team. They should be picking that up between them, shouldn't they?
Yeah, it's poor. It really was poor. Burnley 2, Tottenham Hotspur 1. Ashley Barnes, his 9th of the campaign. Could be a big goal.
Yeah, Ashley Barnes again. Barnes and Wood on the score sheet. Absolutely brilliant from Burnley. Ball fell really nicely for him inside the box. No hint of offside, and he's just slotted it away.
Hello and welcome to the No Name Never podcast, where we are coming off Turf Moor after an absolutely outstanding win against Spurs. A game that was just so important for so many reasons, and it's kept the Clarets on this ridiculously unbeaten run at 8 games now since Boxing Day. And what a massive 3 points to take us towards the end of the season. Puts us, as I'm walking off Turf Moor now, it puts us on 13th place on 30 points. Now, looking at the table, Southampton are currently sat in 18th place, and they've got 24 points. Now, they've got to go away to Arsenal later on today. So let's assume that the results go for us and Arsenal beat them. That puts us 6 points clear of relegation as at the end of this weekend's game. I don't even know where to start with that, and we've got so much to talk about when we get back in studio mode on Monday with the boys. But for me, I don't know how you think, that was a performance of the season for me. From the very first kick of the game, they looked strong. There was a real shape about them. Every player knew where they were. They just were resilient. But more importantly, rather than just sitting back and inviting pressure, they actually created a lot of chances themselves, and they showed some real positive play. For all of his criticism that he's had so far this season, I thought Woody was absolutely outstanding today, to the point where actually it made Ashley Barnes look a little bit quiet. But to have the position where both of our two strikers score, what a partnership those two are having at the moment, and have the rest of the team just play so well, was just a result. And you can't even, I don't think you can ever claim that we actually like lucked out on that one and got ourselves a result we didn't deserve. I think we absolutely deserved it. What have we got to talk about? So there's all sorts happened in the game. There's, well, I guess Tom Heaton, if we look back at there, he pulled off a really good save again, didn't he? We've got to look at the decision by Dyche to keep Brady and Goodmunson on the bench and carry on with McNeil, which we expected anyway, but to keep Hendrick in that right midfield position, which I think my view is that was the right decision and paid off. I think we looked a lot stronger with Hendrick in that role. And actually, how wonderful to have a position where we can change on the 75th minute mark, both of our wingers. That's never happened to us ever. What else do we have to talk about? I think there was the decisions for their goal, Danny Rhodes taking about 56 yards advantage from the free kick, but from the throw-in. But then we'll also have to need to look at the defence there as well. I think there's quite a few of our defenders switched off for their goal. An outstanding performance again by McNeil. There's just so much. We'll unpick it all when we get back at the weekend. After the weekend. I'm all of a flutter. But yeah, fantastic result. Fantastic win. 8 games unbeaten. 30 points. I think we are safe.
And poof, just like that, we are back in studio mode, as promised. Natalie here, joined by Statman Dave and Robert, to carry on where we left off straight after that fantastic victory at home on Saturday, to have a look at it in a little bit more detail and just generally relish in what was a fantastic weekend. Before we go any further, I do want to just say a special thanks to Darren Bentley and Burnley Football Club for very kindly letting us use Statman Dave's commentary from the Clarets player recording at the weekend to open this podcast. It was very kind of him, and obviously we are very grateful. I thought it was absolutely fantastic hearing Dave and Papa Bird cheering those goals, and just that reaction gave me goose pimples to listen to it all over again. They're great to watch those videos, and I think one thing Dave reminded me of before we started recording tonight was that Clarets player videos are now all free. They're not subscription anymore, so if you haven't sort of signed on and checked out some of those, they're definitely worth a watch because they are funny. Dave, you certainly got yourself very excited by that winner. How were you feeling on Saturday after that game? What a fantastic result.
Elated is the word for it. Yeah, it was a fantastic performance and well deserved 3 points at the end of it. I've seen one or two comments about Burnley's performances. We've had other wins against the so-called Big Six sides before, but a lot of them were back to the wall. You think about Liverpool at home, beaten 2-0, 80% possession, all the shots Liverpool had. Man City was the same, the Manchester United home win. Even the Chelsea game, we had a fantastic 45 minutes at Stamford Bridge. And then, second half, even though they were down to 10 men and then 9, it was back to the wall stuff. That was probably the most complete performance, I think, and, really well-deserved 3 points for Burnley against Tottenham.
Yeah, it really was. I think some of the stats were, I was thinking about you after the game actually when I was reading a lot of these, were really, really impressive, because we've once again broken our record, and that's now 8 games unbeaten in the top flight since 1966. I think we're matching that record. But I think more interestingly for me, I was looking at a stat at the weekend, Dave, and looking at the losses in the Premier League in 2019. Now, obviously, we know that we've not lost a game since that awful Boxing Day result against Everton. But out of all of the Premier League sides in 2019, we've lost no games at all. City have lost 1. Liverpool have lost 2. Spurs have lost 3. No, sorry, Spurs have lost 2. And Arsenal have lost 3. There's only us and United that have not lost any games in 2019. Now, that is just, taking aside the beginning of the season and everything else, you know, all the narrative you can look at with Burnley Football Club, Dave, that's an incredible start.
It is, and it's a real turnaround as well, as you say, from Boxing Day to be where we were there halfway through the season on 12 points. We've picked up 18 points in 8 matches. That's another half, the same number of points and half as many again in 8 games. So it has been a real turnaround, and it's credit to the players and the manager for doing that. And it's not been by fluke. Burnley could have easily got more points than we have got. We've had one or two decisions, borderline decisions gone against us late in games where we might have sneaked a win in the games where we drew, and Manchester United as well being so close there, conceding a couple of late goals when a little bit of luck going our way, and we may not have done that with a soft penalty decision in there as well. So yeah, it's been a real turnaround, but it's been a real positive place to be around Turf Moor, and obviously for the fans going to the away games as well. They've seen some really good solid Burnley performances, and it's a settled side as well. We've gone in there, I think it's 6 consecutive games without changing the starting 11. It's a really settled side now, and it's paying dividends with the results on the pitch.
It definitely is. I think for me, there's just an atmosphere at Turf, and I actually thought on Saturday it was one of the best atmospheres that I've heard at Turf this season as well. It was definitely rocking from the off. It's interesting you talk there, Dave, about how we could have actually had some results go better for us. If you look at the Watford and the United games, we could have easily won 8 games back to back, which would have just been an incredible feat, other than, like you say, a little bit of bad luck going against us. But as Darch always says, you hope that these things even itself out by the end of the season, and we're going to talk about in a little bit possible good luck and good fortune that's coming our way. Robbie, Dave talked then about just a confidence and an air of just, I guess, swagger almost about the side. And I wonder whether that is why Hendrick kept his place in the squad. I think a few people before the game were maybe questioning, not this is not in a bad way, by the way. I think everybody was generally happy with the unchanged side. But I think a few people expected to see Goodmunson come straight back in on that right wing. But Dyche opted to stay with Hendrick, which may have been, I guess, unexpected. But I thought it was very well justified. I thought he was very, very strong and gave us a real resilience to that side.
Yeah, it looks like Jeff Hendrick's sort of found his home. He's sort of been used as like a utility player for us, you know, playing like behind a striker, which he never really got the hang of. Then when we play in a 4-4-2, it looks like he more suits a deeper role in a 3. But on the right-hand side, he does look at home. I thought he was terrific. I thought he defended against Danny Rose brilliantly. But just on the game, I just thought the team just showed tremendous like character and the spirit, you know, after going ahead and then conceding such a sloppy Harry Kane equaliser, we seemed to go up another gear. I must admit, when it went 1-1, I was sort of going, oh, here we go again. You know, that sort of same feeling I had at Old Trafford and when we went ahead against Liverpool. And I feel like we've sort of learned our lesson that maybe we do invite a bit too much pressure on ourselves when we go ahead. And I think once the equaliser went in, it's like we sort of stepped up a gear and started going back and sort of kind of went back on the front foot again. And I think a lot of credit goes to Sean Dyche as well, because at 1-1, with 10-15 minutes to play, he could easily just sort of shut up shop. But he made two attacking subs with Brady and Gummonson coming on. You could argue the like for like, but I just think it sort of just exposed the fullbacks for Spurs, who were left exposed a little bit, and it changed the game for us, really.
Yeah, it really did. I'm glad you mentioned that, Robbie, because I can't remember the last time that we actually had 4 wide men fit, never mind be able to make a double substitution in a game and actually just replace both wings. I couldn't agree more on Hendrick, if we just go back to that for a second. It feels to me that that's where his place is now, and maybe that has changed the shopping list for the summer. If you look at the team now with the 4 wide men who played on Saturday and swapped around, plus Lennon to come in as well, we have now got some real options on that wing. We've got 2 on either side, plus Lennon, who can probably swap around both. Which then, if you then look at it, maybe means we need strengthening on the central midfield, because we've probably only got... in fact, I can't think of anybody else we have got. We've got Westwood and we've got Cork in the centre, who are pretty much set in stone as being first choice starters now. But we don't really have any options there. My view is Defoe will go in the summer, or, you know, we certainly shouldn't be building a team around him on the grounds that he has got fitness questions. And as much as I love him, he is a luxury player, and I just don't think we can count on him week in, week out. But it's just incredible to see that now, my luck, that in the space of, what, a month after the transfer window closed, we're changing our minds and our shopping list again. Dave, one of the things that I was really impressed at was just the pressing play of Burnley, of our squad. They didn't let the Spurs players settle or play the ball for 1 second. They marked man for man. They didn't give them a minute's peace. And actually, they didn't let the Spurs midfielders dictate the pace at all. And in sometimes as well, they really forced the Spurs side to play a long ball, which is hilarious, given that's what we're accused of all the time.
Well, yeah, I mean, Spurs' goal in the end came from sort of a... I guess a long ball being a long throw, it was kind of a long hoof forward from a throw-in, albeit from the wrong place. I guess we'll come on to that later. But yeah, it was putting them off their game. They weren't able to perhaps play and have the luxury of passing it around like they would against some of the bigger sides that they may play against. And they struggled with it to some extent, I think. And it's Burnley defending from the front. You have two players in Chris Wood and Ashley Barnes who they harry, they come back, they drop deep. They're willing to put in a real workload. And you've got four midfielders as well. You've not just got your two central midfielders. You've got Jeff Hendrick and Dwight McNeil as well, who really put in a shift. I'd be interested in seeing some of the stats in terms of the ground covered, because all four across midfield do really put in a shift for Burnley. And I think the way they're playing now, and also the players coming on as well, we've spoken just then about the options in terms of bringing Gudmundsson on, and also Robbie Brady as well. We've got players in there who, they're all playing to the same system, but they've got a real work ethic, and it's paying dividends for Burnley, and it definitely paid dividends on Saturday.
It certainly did. Sticking with you for a little while, Dave, I'm just going to move away from all things claret for the time being, because it would be, I guess, strange not to mention the England setup following Saturday's game. Gareth Southgate was once again at Turf Moor. I swear he actually has a season ticket these days. He's at Turf that many times. But I guess if you look at Burnley versus Spurs, it's probably not at all surprising given just how many England senior options he has in that squad. So I guess before we look at the Burnley contingent, as England captain, we don't usually focus on opposition players, but how do you think Harry Kane did play on his way back? And I guess particularly that cheeky strike that he tried that Heaton saved spectacularly was definitely some ego, wasn't it?
There weren't too many hints of any hangover from his injury. He came in there, he had a shot very early on, just dragged it wide of Tom Heaton's post. He might have been struggling to clamber for that if it had gone on target. Obviously scored the goal and had that long distance shot, which Tom Heaton had a spectacular diving save to his right hand side. Really strong right hand to keep that one out as well. But maybe in terms of his all round game, wasn't back to 100%, but a 90 or 95% Harry Kane's going to be a handful for any side. And Burnley did really well to marshal him. And to be fair, going back for the away game, the one down at Wembley, it was pretty much the same. Devastating that Burnley conceded that goal late on when it looked like we'd grabbed a point out of the game. But again, Harry Kane didn't have too many chances in that game either.
Yeah, you see, Harry Kane's a handful for anybody apart from Ben Mee, who has it in his pocket. Robbie, I guess the one Harry Kane incident which really allowed our side and one player in particular to showcase his skills to the watching England manager was that strike. Heaton once again just showing an incredible talent, especially given that I don't think he had that much to do on Saturday. I think he had a relatively routine afternoon. But to show that athleticism, to get that palm onto that Harry Kane shot when nobody else other than Harry Kane would probably have the audacity to try it in the first place. For me, and I don't know how you feel, is he now an absolute must to not just be in the squad, but to be the starting keeper for England?
I'm not sure about starting goalkeeper, but he certainly warrants a call up. It's actually interesting because I was speaking to Paul Robinson at work earlier in the week, and I was speaking to him about who's Burnley's strongest goalkeeper. And he, despite how well Nick Pope's come on, he always says that Tom Heaton is just athleticism and he's just professionalism and he's always trying to get better. And even how old is he now? 30, 31, Tom Heaton. And he just seems to get better. He seems like a better goalkeeper now than he did before his injury, which really surprises me.
I would definitely agree with that. And me and Mr. B were talking about this on Saturday after the game. I think he was concerned that Heaton would maybe not peak again after his injury. He was out for such a long time. He had such a frustrating wait on the touchline. But I agree with you, Robbie. He actually looks better. Sticking with you, obviously, Southgate had an awful lot of other players to look at. Tarkowski, we know, has already forced his way into the England side. But there's a couple of other names on there as well. I mean, Jack Cooks has had a call-up. He's been in the squad. And to me, I don't know why he's not looking at him still. But is it only a matter of time before young Dwight McNeil gets a look in?
I'm surprised I haven't seen reports of him maybe playing for the under-21s. I think maybe a senior call-up's probably a little bit too early. And we need to remember that we need to tell everyone that he's still rubbish. Like, we're not having him, not having any other clubs like sifting around him. Not having this. No. Everyone,
that's
everyone
such
looking
a Burnley
at him,
word.
He's crap. Don't like.
Yes. Can we make a public service announcement right now, thank you, that No Name Never does not in any way endorse the skills of Dwight McNeil. He's a rubbish player and nobody should be interested in him. Robert, I completely agree about the under-21s. We know from previous interviews that Southgate still has that preference towards players who have developed through the England ranks from under-21s, under-16s, right the way up. He has been forced in recent times to have to use players such as Nick Pope, for example, who haven't got, and Jamie Vardy as well, who don't have any youth experience and no academy. Southgate likes to have a file on these players. He likes to know all about them. So, you know, if he is looking at McNeil now and recognises that talent, then he should be getting him in that under-21 setup ASAP, because that is then going to naturally move him on to move into the England squad. I just think he's incredible. Dave, is Ben Mee ever going to get a look in? I know Tarkowski is an incredible talent. I know Michael Keane was an incredible talent. But there is a constant with these players. And they play better when they're alongside Ben Mee. And I thought Mee had another absolutely outstanding game on Saturday. But he keeps getting overlooked.
He does. And he's not the first player in that position. You look at the likes of Steve Bruce for Manchester United going back a few years. You know, he playing for a top side and never got a look in for England. It may be one of those things with Ben, he never gets the chance. I don't know. It's maybe it comes down to the system as well. If Gareth Southgate's still looking to play three at the back, then that might be in his mind in terms of wanting to play players who tend to play in that system for their teams as well. I don't know. It's one of those things. You know, he's got the final decision at the end of the day. But yeah, I mean, we've seen what Ben Mee's capable of, and we've seen him alongside, as you say, bringing on really Michael Keane and also James Tarkowski as well. And the one constant's been Ben Mee. He's one of those players who, you know, gives 100% every game. He's a real warrior. And it is a shame he's been overlooked so far. And like us, we'll just have to wait and see. And if Gareth Southgate ever gives him that call, but he was there, he saw it firsthand on Saturday. It's not the first time. We know he's been to see several games at Turf Moor. As Gareth Southgate, as you say, he's virtually got a season ticket at the place, and he had a lot of players to choose from on Saturday, not just on the Burnley side, but also Spurs side as well. I mean, we've not even mentioned Ashley Westwood here as well. I mean, is his performance as well. You know, perhaps that overshadows, I think, in terms of his performance, although Jack Cork's been impressive, I think Ashley Westwood's been even more impressive in the Burnley midfield. So is Gareth Southgate after that sort of player for his midfield as well? So there's numerous options for him on offer. He's the man who's going to decide, and we'll find out, I guess, in a week or so.
Yeah, that's a really good point about Westwood, actually. And I think if you asked me now and said you can only send one Burnley midfielder to that senior England setup, I would probably choose Westwood over Cork.
Yeah.
One of the things I think I've been impressed with Westwood recently is that he has replaced that Joey Barton role in terms of leadership and strength on the pitch. He just goes about his business. He's very consistent in his approach, and he's very reliable in the balls that he plays and the defensive work that he does as well. And I think he's got more of a captain's ability to him than maybe Jack Cork does. Jack Cork's an incredibly tricky player, and he's a very talented player, but he's quite an unassuming character, and he's quite quiet on the pitch. So I wouldn't necessarily put forward Jack Cork as a captain type player. But Westwood's been really driving that midfield recently, and I think since he moved to the right, so has Hendrick as well. We did actually also have another international manager at Turf on Saturday. The Austrian manager was there, finally checking out his soon-to-be top-scoring, amazing international, fire them to the Euros, the World Cup, everywhere they need to go, Ashley Barnes. I'll come to you, Robbie, on this one. I saw an absolutely fantastic quote at the weekend, which really, really made me laugh, describing an actually fantastic partnership that has formed this season between Chris Wood and Ashley Barnes after quite a slow start. And the quote was that Barnes and Wood are the most unconvincing but deadly strike force in the Premier League. And, okay, there's a little bit of a... of needling in there, but on the whole, I'd take that as tongue in cheek. But what an absolutely incredible partnership they've done. They've actually scored all 8 of the last 8 goals that Burnley have scored between them, and it's 17 out of 17 when they've started together.
Yeah, they've been on a similar run like this. I think it was back end of last season towards March, April time where the partnership really flourished. I think it was like West Ham away, Chris would come on and really made an impact. He did the same against Everton as well, where they both scored. And they just seem just to suit one another. I think they both played together at Brighton as well, so they do have that sort of long-term understanding together. But I just think Chris Wood, I've got to say, he's a completely different player from the player that was starting for us back in September. He looks so much quicker. He looks like he has like 3 yards... extra, a bit like extra pace all the time. He's just everything about him. I thought on Saturday was probably his best performance in a Burnley shirt, a 10 out of 10 performance. There's the way he ran the channels and held the ball up, and I think his header for the goal is really, really good as well.
Yeah, I completely agree. And to be honest, I was quite surprised that Sky gave Ashley Barnes the man of the match, not because Barnes doesn't deserve it, but I think out of the two of them, I think Wood was probably a little bit stronger than Barnes on Saturday. I agree with you. I thought it was an incredible performance. Dave, do you think it's just confidence with Wood, or do you think there's something else?
I think there's a team confidence as well. I think when you're playing well as a team, then that sort of, this, you know, it goes all the way through the team. I think if we've had issues in one area of the pitch, then that can affect players, and that may be what happened earlier on in the season. You know, we did struggle in the first half of the season, and it's probably quite a dispiriting job at times when you're not getting the service up front. And we were struggling to get service to the front players in those games. Going back to the strikers, or in terms of Ashley Barnes. We haven't mentioned Ashley Barnes in terms of the England setup. He's a little bit cagey in his interview. He still qualifies for England, being born in England, and also for Austria through his grandparents, I believe. And although Franco Foda was there for Austria watching the match, maybe he'll need to nip in and get in there quickly to get ahead of Gareth Southgate.
That would be hilarious, wouldn't it? I don't think I've ever wanted a player to be called up for England more than Ashley Barnes. What an absolutely incredible journey he will have been on if he gets there. I remember when we signed him in the 2013-14 season, when he came in as emergency cover because both Danny Ings and Sam Bourke's... Oh, God. I'm still upset about Sam. When they both got injured. And we had questions back at the time whether he was strong enough to play in the Championship. And he's now one of the most prolific strikers, and he's a dangerous striker in the Premier League, and a lot of sides would be really happy to have him. I guess if you were Ashley Barnes, you'd maybe choose Austria just on the grounds that you are more likely to play every game if you get into that squad, whereas his chances of being called up for England and actually playing would be maybe once in a lifetime. I don't know. Who knows what Ashley Barnes' international prospects are? Or actually ambitions, I guess. Well, let's get down to the nitty-gritty. Obviously, I think that's a unanimous vote from all of us that was an incredible performance on Saturday. But let's have a look at two of the maybe 4 controversial moments in the game. And of course, we're referring to goal number 1, Burnley going ahead, and goal number 2, Spurs equalising. This is probably unsurprising given that this is a Burnley podcast, but I think that the first goal is less controversial than the second. I'm pretty sure that all the Spurs podcasts out there will completely disagree and say that I was. In fact, I've actually seen some news reports that don't even mention the controversy around the second goal. It's like, well, you know, top six bias. Robbie, we know now from watching ridiculous slow-mo, every single angle possibly, and repeat it about 500 times, that the ball did indeed touch Jeff Hendricks. So it was technically a goal kick. In time, when you were watching the game, did you know which one it was? Could you even tell? And secondly, how do you feel about the game moving to that level of perfection in-game?
Well, live, I could see quite clearly that it did come off Hendrick. But like, obviously, I'm a Burnley fan, so I'm going to call for the corner. But I've got to say, I do sort of agree. I think if VAR comes into that like next year or whatever, I think it does sort of take it away a little bit. I think you don't want like video assistant referees going to be stopping the game over every little incident, and because I don't see that as like a refereeing mistake or a linesman's mistake. It's incredibly tough to call. You just have to be in the right position to see it. It's just two players going for a 50-50 ball essentially, and it does come off Jeff Hendrick last, unfortunately.
But correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, but I always thought that in situations like that, where it's practically impossible to the naked eye to be able to see it, the advantage goes to the attacking player, doesn't it? Or have I made that up?
I'm not sure in terms of specific ruling. I know that the officials have given the decision their instinct at that time. They get a split second to see it and decide, and you know, they've given a corner for it. We know now, as you say, from multiple slow motion replays and about six angles, that it wasn't the case. You can probably forgive them for getting that one wrong, but that's a less obvious mistake, as you say, than for the one where after that, where Tottenham had a throw in their own half and ended up taking it about 8 or 9 yards further down the pitch, right in front of the fourth official. So when we're talking about fine margins, yeah, the first one was fine margin, and we've come out, it's benefited Burnley for that one. But for the second one, there's a massive gulf in terms of the benefit that Tottenham have got for that, taking the long throw, 8-9 yards further forward than from where it should have been. So the officials have got that one wrong, massively wrong, whereas the first one is, yeah, very, very marginal.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to go on and talk about the second goal in a minute, actually. I think let's just hang fire on the second one for now. But I don't think VAR is actually going to come in and rule on that next season, is it? From what I understand, it's only goals and penalties or something to clarify where the fourth official on the line believes that the referee has got an absolutely categoric decision wrong. So I certainly don't think things like goal kicks and corners and things like that will get picked up on it. But regardless of that, Robbie, just how good was McNeil's corner that resulted from it? And obviously that we got the goal from that one. But I just wanted to pause for a minute before we move on to the second goal, and just, I think we might have peaked at corners. I'm not sure he'll ever deliver one as good as that again.
I think he's the only corner that actually beat the first man. I think Westwood took one in the second half earlier and he just hit the first man. I know Robbie Brady did the same thing when he first came onto the pitch. So maybe Dwight McNeil should take corners more often.
Maybe he should. I did laugh actually when Westwood tried it, and I think he tried to do exactly the same corner and it failed miserably. And I could almost imagine him saying, "Lads, like I've seen Dwight do this. I can do it. Oh no, I can't do it." So yeah, obviously that did put us 1-0 up, and I was absolutely purring over the skill of McNeil to get that in there. Obviously, as Dave's started to mention then, Robert, we then move on to the second goal, which for us is less controversial, which obviously then got our opposition manager riled at the end of it. So what happens? The ball essentially goes out of play for a throw-in directly on the halfway line. If you look at the footage, it's literally on the halfway line. The free kick ends up going out of play. I think if you look at the grass, it's about 8 yards. Some people are a bit hyperbole about it and say it's about 15 yards. Some are saying it's 1 or 2 yards. It's not 1 or 2 yards. It's about 8 yards. I'm going to say how I feel and then I'll leave it back to you, Rob, to see how you feel. To me, the distance that he steals, I don't think I'm that bothered about. I don't think I can get that excited about, because it happens every single game. I can't remember the last time that players actually took a throw-in from right where the free kick went. Sorry, the throw-in went out. And actually, we do it all the time as well. Westwood and Lawton are two of the biggest culprits in our team. Whenever they can steal 5 or 6 yards, they will do. So you can't... you can't whinge at that, because everybody does it. And actually, when you look at it in real time, I don't think he steals that much space, to be honest. The issue for me is the role that the fourth official plays in this whole incident. If you're an official, be it a linesman, a referee, the fourth official, whoever you are, you do not touch that ball. But instead, the ball comes out and Dyche has admitted that it was a human reaction, and the fourth official realised a mistake he'd make as soon as he did. He collects the ball and he throws it to Danny Rose, who's running towards him. Now, what that then means is that Rose is already running when he catches the ball, and he just carries on and sees the opportunity to take the quick free kick. So that therefore means that he does go a little bit further down the pitch because the momentum's taken him there, but it also gives him the opportunity to take the advantage of a very quick free kick. If the fourth official does not touch that ball and it runs out, Danny Rose has to run over, he stops, he either picks up the ball himself or somebody on his bench passes it to him, or one of the ball boys passes it to him. He then walks back to the line and his feet are stationary and he has stopped. In that 20 seconds, 10 seconds even, that it takes for that momentum to be taken off, the Burnley players have switched back on and they have moved back into position, and he doesn't get he might still steal 5 yards, because everybody does, but he doesn't have the pace and the ability to throw as far because he's not running while he's throwing it. And I think the whole thing plays out differently. So, Robert, where do you sit with that? Are you more concerned with them stealing the yards? Are you more concerned with the fourth official? I guess, back me up here. What just was wrong with that?
Yeah, you basically just said what I was about to mention. It's the fact that the four official interferes when he's not allowed to. And then because Danny Rose is already running, the momentum that he generates to throw the ball that far just allows Harry Kane just to run onto the loose ball. And like you say, most every single player will gain a few yards when they take a throw in. But it's the fact that he's actually like sprinting. He's literally sprinting with the ball in his hands and he literally whizzes it just into Harry Kane. And Ben Mee, at that point, it's either he hacks him down for a penalty and gets sent off, or you just gotta hope that Harry Kane can't put it into the only place he can put it, but he's a world-class striker and he does. Because I think you have to give Harry Kane credit. It is a terrific like finish. But yeah, the four officials just got one horribly wrong. And like Dyche said, it is like a human action. But thankfully, we did step up and we got a second goal. So I'm not going to cry over it too much.
Yeah, I'm still going to cry over it because it always seems to happen to us. Dave, taking aside the free kick, the throwing itself and obviously the controversy surrounding that, I was a little bit disappointed about how much our defence went to sleep when the ball came into play. Very uncharacteristic for us in that particular game. I think it's probably the only mistake they made in the entire 90 minutes. Phil Bardsley was actually the only one who was switched off. And I think when you look at the replays, you can see him screaming at Ben Mee and saying, watch him, watch him, watch him. And obviously by the time the throw-in's done, it's far too late. I think for you, Dave, was that disappointing to see, or do you think he just got done by a world-class striker?
I think it's a combination. It's the fact that obviously they were able to take the throw-in at speed from the place it shouldn't have been taken at. But then, as you say, that being said, we should still be defending it. And it was the one time in the game, really, that we did switch off slightly. And it was mentioned as well, I think... James Tarkowski was interviewed after the match, and you know he was more than aware of it, as you'd expect him to be as a top player, and it'll be something that the players do learn from. And thankfully, as Robbie's mentioned, at the end, you know, we got the winning goal, and we can consign that to history, and it's not affected the game. You know, either the the Burnley defence switching off for the one moment in the game they did, or the controversy that that led to it in the first place.
Yeah, definitely. But Dave, just picking up on something else that Robbie said, Ben, and I don't think enough people have really given him credit for this. Ben Mee could easily have brought down Harry Kane and got himself sent off. And I think he showed an incredible defensive intelligence to just realise, well, he's probably going to score here. I'm better trying to stay in this game at 11 versus 11 and try and see if we can get another winner, or at least take the point if we need to. It's still a fantastic point, rather than bring him down, get myself sent off, and then I'm not available for the Palace game and give ourselves a 10-man advantage. I think that was an incredibly smart piece of play.
It was, yeah. I mean, it was one of those where, you know, even though Harry Kane's a top player, it's coming across from a position that's a really tight angle. And there was literally one place in the corner where he could have scored it past Tom Heaton, and he did. He put it right in that position, which as a top striker, they have a tendency to do. But it wasn't a foregone conclusion. Ben Mee was kind of up with him and did enough to try and put him off, but obviously not enough to put him off. Anything more, you know, if it had clipped him, more than likely it'd have been sent off, and then it would have been a real uphill battle. So, yeah, I think in the instance, you know, these things do happen in an instant, and it was, you know, the right decision that was made by Ben not to do anything more than that, even though it ended up with a goal. You know, at the end, after that, Burnley were able to recover from it and press on. So I think when Burnley scored from that corner, we'd done really well first half. It was 0-0. Tottenham were probably the better side in the second half. Certainly had a lot more possession, a lot more of the play in their attacking half. Burnley didn't have as many chances in the second half. So to do that and then come back, yeah, it was good. And we went up a gear, you know, after that. After the equaliser went in, Burnley were the better side, pushing for that goal, particularly with the positive substitution we've mentioned earlier on as well. The fact that we made a double substitution, brought two players on with about 10 minutes to go. There've been other times when, you know, earlier in the season, perhaps we wouldn't have been as likely to make those sort of changes that we did. And yeah, the atmosphere, everything, players really went pushed on, got that goal, and it was the right result in the end. I think Burnley deserved it on the balance of play, even though they, you know, fewer passes, less possession, but it wasn't a real one-sided game. Burnley were really in it, and to my mind, it was the best performance we've had against any of the top six sides since we've been back in the Premier League.
Well said, Dave. I completely agree with everything you just said. That was very, very, very succinctly put. I like it. Final talking point then from the game, a couple of red card controversies. Depending on which camp you sit in, one was more obvious than the other. Dave, I will start with you first. A very early challenge by Foyth on Chris Wood. Both feet off the ground, which to me is a red card, but possibly redeemed himself just at the end by just pulling out of the tackle and therefore taking Chris Wood's knee with his knee. Red card or not?
I think on balance after the event, then no. I think it's one of those that Sean Dyche describes as maybe an orange, and to his mind, those should be erred on the safe side and be a yellow card. So I think that, I wouldn't say that's a red card. I might have been saying, if you listen back to the commentary, I probably said something different. But in the cold light of day, probably not.
I love that. I love the fact that Dave is just so calm and so calculated and is a real voice of reason in my chaos, but every now and again also gets carried away with in-game moments. Robbie, the second one, Phil Bardsley's challenge on Danny Rose, red or not?
I think it's more of a red than the fight.
Just a bit.
I don't think there's enough in it. I think I understand the argument behind it, that he is coming in at it at pace. His leg is out full stretch, but I think Danny Rose is jumping as well, and I think that his leg just goes up with him. I don't think there's any. I think it's just an orange rather than a straight red.
Interesting. Well, my view, for what it's worth, I completely agree with Dave in that the Foyth challenge was probably a yellow/orange. I have to disagree with Robbie. I hate doing it, Robbie. I'm so sorry. But I think Phil Bosley is a very, very, very lucky boy today. And I think it was a red. I'm sorry. So there's nothing else really to discuss from the game other than just a sense of absolute euphoria. I think Burnley fans came away from that game just in such a lovely mood because it wasn't a hang on, it wasn't a lucky point, it wasn't a lucky win even. It was a really, really strong performance from a side that just looks miles away from that side that got absolutely battered on Boxing Day at Everton. And what an absolutely fantastic turnaround this season. Puts us now 6 points clear of the bottom three. Luckily, Southampton didn't manage to pull another shock result out of the bag against Arsenal and stayed on 24 points. We're not out of it yet. I mean, obviously 6 points could vanish. I think if we lost against both Palace and Newcastle the next two games coming up, we might find ourselves back in it. But certainly life is looking a lot rosier than it was maybe 5 or 6 games ago. Now, with that in mind, we do have those next two games coming up. Newcastle away Tuesday night. We are recording this final part of the podcast on Monday, so that is tomorrow. And then at home to Palace on Saturday. Dave, let's look at Newcastle first. And apologies if you are listening to this after the Newcastle game and we know whether we did it or not. But let's have a look at it anyway. What can we possibly expect from a head-to-head tomorrow night?
Yeah, well, looking back on the previous matches, it's a bit of a milestone match, really, is this one. It's the 50th time we'll have played a league match at St James's Park. And it's also the 100th league meeting between the two sides as well. So, interesting one from that point of view. We don't have the best of records at Newcastle, certainly not in recent seasons. We've had 14 wins in total, which is not too bad compared to some of the ones we've had this season. But a lot of those wins were in the early days. When you look back, I think 7 of those 14 wins were prior to the Second World War. So, you know, we're going back to games that, you know, no one's going to remember in any detail anyway. So we have to come back to a little bit more recent times for some better results. Starting off from World War II onwards, we had a 2-1 win in September 1946, future manager Harry Potts scored 2 for Burnley, and then we had a poor run then. We had 9 matches, 6 defeats and 3 draws. One of those was a cup defeat as well in 1954, before Burnley got the next win, which was in April 1958. There was a 3-1 win. And then Burnley also won at Newcastle in the title-winning season as well, 1959-60. Early on that season in September, Burnley had a 3-1 win. Jimmy Mack scored a goal and John Kennelly got the other two. The following season as well, early on 1960, Jimmy Robson scored a goal for a 1-0 win. And then we didn't have anything else through until the 1970s. We get to the mid-1970s. Burnley were in the FA Cup semi-final, got beaten by Newcastle at Hillsborough in the semi-final. It's the end of March 1974. And then we had 2 further games at Newcastle after that, so we still haven't played them in the league. So literally less than 2 weeks after the heartbreak of the semi-final defeat in 1974, we went up to Newcastle and we beat them in the league 2-1. Jeff Nulty and Martin Dobson scored the goals for Burnley. And then we also played them in a cup final. The Texaco Cup final took place 2 weeks after that, 24th of April 1974. But Newcastle came out on top. They won 2-1 with Paul Fletcher scoring Burnley's consolation goal in that one. And then going forward, we go forward to 1976, which was 1975-76 season, was Burnley's last one in the top flight before a 33-year gap. And we had a 1-0 win. Peter Noble, who's Sunderland-born, but actually started his career at Newcastle, he scored the only goal in a 1-0 win for Burnley in April 1976. But by then, it was pretty much too late. Burnley were stranded and we were relegated that season. We haven't played Newcastle too many times since then. There's only been 5 other games. We've had in the second division, it was the second division before the Premier League came about, in the late 70s and early 80s, we had 2 defeats and a draw. And then a big gap between 1982 and 2015 before we actually played them again at Newcastle. New Year's Day 2015 was an interesting game. Finished 3-3. Burnley had to make all three substitutions in the first half through injuries. Kevin Long came on for his Burnley debut and then got injured himself. He did his cruciate, went off and had to be... We had to have a real change around to try and accommodate a back four from what we had left. But we managed to come back and we won 3-3. George Boyd scored the third goal in that game. And then going back to last season, we played them end of January. That was a 1-1 draw and Burnley got an own goal from Darlow, was credited with the goal in the end. To make it 1-1. So we've not won at Newcastle since 1976, so we might be due one.
I like that. We're due one. I was about to start that new piece with it. Oh, God, Dave, give us some good news. But you're right, you know what? We're due one. Spurs, we didn't think we had any chance of beating them at home. We're just going to go to Newcastle and we're going to stop them in their tracks and we're going to win. Robbie, taking aside Dave's quite upsetting stats. What's your gut feeling about tomorrow night? It's going to be a really tough game. In fact, the next two are going to be really tough. What's your gut telling you? What do you think we'll do?
Like I say, it's a tough one because Newcastle are on quite a decent run of form. Like I say, they're all a little bit excited over Miguel Almiron, who's joining from Atlanta, who looks a real threat from midfield. Both sides relatively solid. I don't think either side will want to lose it, so I'm going to go for a 0-0 draw.
I think I'd probably take that, to be honest. I think a draw away at Newcastle would be a fine result, as Deitch would say. Dave, what are you feeling? I feel like we must be absolutely flying in confidence, and I don't know. I feel like we can get something from the game. Do you not think so?
Yeah, I think we can build on the performances we've had, and we don't really fear anyone. I mean, it's a tough game. We know it's going to be tough. We don't have a good record up there. And it's probably going to be a cagey game with Newcastle being just a couple of points behind us after beating Newcastle on Saturday. So a draw, yeah, I mean, both sides would love to have 3 points, but a point gets both of us a little bit further away from the teams beneath us. So, I'll go for a 1-1. That'll be my prediction for Tuesday night.
I like it. I'm happy to do that. I'm going up to Newcastle tomorrow night, so I'm going to do my best to cheer them on as much as I can. Obviously, we're not going to have... I don't think we're going to look too much at stats for Saturday, but obviously by the time our next recording comes around, we'll have played both Newcastle and Palace. Dave, I kind of have a similar feeling to the Palace game on Saturday as I do for Newcastle, but both of these games are games that we could easily win, but could easily lose as well. It looks to me like Newcastle, Palace and Burnley have got themselves slightly ahead of the bottom players. If you assume that Fulham and Huddersfield are down now, it seems like there's a bit of a straight shootout between Cardiff, Brighton and Southampton. It just feels like Burnley, Palace and Newcastle have maybe just got their noses in front a little bit. So we could easily lose, but easily win.
Yeah, it's changed around quite a bit. So when you're looking at particularly the betting odds for Southampton, they were out sort of 15-20 to 1. You're thinking, well, you know, they're only like a point or so ahead of where Burnley were. But you know, maybe at that time they were factoring in the fact that new manager had come in and their performances and results had turned around a little bit. They've gone a little bit backwards since then, and the odds have changed around. You can get 12 to 1 now for Burnley to be relegated. So if there's any pessimistic Burnley fans out there, stick 30 quid on Burnley to be relegated. P.S. it's not going to happen. And that just about pays for your season ticket for next year.
Gamble responsibly. Robbie, final word from you then. What would you consider a decent result from the next two games from Newcastle and Palace?
Well, it's interesting because before the Spurs game, I said I'd take 4 points from like Spurs, Newcastle and Palace, but now we've already got 3. I'd be kind of disappointed if we only got 4. So I think if we got, I'd say a point at Newcastle, and I think we have to beat Palace considering we're the home side. I think we have to beat Palace. So we've got 4 points for our next two. I think I'd be absolutely delighted with that.
Yeah, I would as well. And that would, of course, put us on 10 games unbeaten, which would just be crazy considering the start we had, and considering some of the teams that we've had to play in this 10-game run, that would just be amazing. And I share both of your optimism, actually. I genuinely think we can make it now 10 games unbeaten. And let's hope that's the case. That is all we have time for this week. We are all ecstatic. It's been an absolutely fantastic weekend. One of those weekends that just puts everybody in a good mood, and everybody's pulling together and everybody's celebrating the fact that we've got something special with these players. And they've had a really rough time this season, and Dyche has had a rough time. He's had to put up with a lot of stick. He's had questions asked of his managerial style, quite rightly, I think, at times. But he's answered them, and we wanted him to turn it around, and we wanted him to put us all back on track, and he has done that. And what a fantastic end to the season. And let's just hope now we've just done enough to just retain our Premier League status this season, and then we can really push on next year and see where else it can take us. As ever, we've got plenty of people to thank for this week's episode. Thanks to Roberto and Statman Dave for joining me this week and just chatting through the key topics of the week, and also managing to keep me very calm and not get excited and think that we're going to end up in Europe by the end of the season. Thanks to our producer, Matt, for editing us and making us sound a lot better than we are. Thanks, Matt. And also, there's been quite a few production things this week as well, so sorry about that, Matt. Thanks again, as ever, to you for downloading and listening to this podcast. Your support is so very much appreciated, and we would not be here without you. We will be back in a week's time to look back at an away game at Newcastle and a home game at Palace, and hopefully 10 games unbeaten. I've been Natalie Bromley. This has been the Known and Never podcast. Until next time.